Hello, I'm Representative Connie Bernardi, and welcome to the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee in the Minnesota House of Representatives. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call the remote meeting of the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Christensen, present. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
O'Neill, present. Representative Albright.
Present.
Albright, present. Representative Daniels.
Present.
Daniels, present. Representative Erickson. Representative Erickson. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Hansen, present. Representative Heintzman.
Present.
Heintzman, present. Representative Howard. Representative Howard. Representative Keeler.
Present.
Keeler, present. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, present.
Cleavorn, present. Representative Kosnick. Representative Kosnick. Representative Crenshaw. Representative Mason.
Mason, present.
Mason, present. Representative Mecklund.
Mecklund, present.
Mecklund, present. Representative Knorr.
Knorr, present.
Knorr, present. Representative Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Representative Sandsted.
Present.
Sandsted, present. Representative Thompson.
Thompson, present.
Thompson, present. Representative Erickson. Representative Howard. And Representative Kosnick. And a quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 9th, 2021?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Knorr moves approval of the minutes for March 9th. 2021. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Aye. The motion prevails and the minutes for March 9th, 2021 are approved. Now I'm going to hand over the gavel to our vice chair today. Representative Vice Chair Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members will be taking up House File 1181 from Chair Bernardi today. This is the OHE policy bill that we walked through on February 24th of this year. We will begin by giving Chair Bernardi a chance to introduce her bill along with her author's amendments, followed by a walkthrough of each of the provisions by OHE staff, and then finally we'll have time for amendments, member discussion, and questions. We have House File 1181 from Chair Bernardi. Chair Bernardi, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 1181 to be referred to the Committee on Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Chair Bernardi has a pair of author amendments. The first of these is labeled A4. I will move A4 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author wants. Does everyone have the amendment? I will ask Mr. Hopkins to give us an overview of the changes that the A4 amendment makes.
Madam Chair and members, the A4 amendment makes a number of purely technical changes that were also adopted by the Senate when they heard the Senate companion to this bill. It makes a few substantive changes, which I will point out by mentioning the page and line numbers in the unofficial engrossment, which was provided in the email from Mr. Herring. The unofficial engrossment shows what HF 1181 will look like when the A4 amendment is adopted and engrossed into it. So if you look at the unofficial engrossments, to point out some of the substantive changes that the A4 amendment makes. On page 2, line 6, this is the transcript access section, the new section. The $1,000 threshold regarding student debt is lowered to $500 in the A4 amendment. Also, page 2, line 15 of the unofficial engrossment, there is a new subdivision added, which requires institutions to have policies regarding using transcript issuance as a tool for debt collection. Moving on to page 4 of the unofficial engrossment, you'll see missing from the unofficial engrossment what was section 4 of the as introduced version. This was the income contingent loans section. The Office of Higher Education in the as introduced version proposed amending a defunct statute to provide more flexibility in offering income contingent or income-based loan repayment programs. The A4 amendment deletes that section and moves the statute regarding the defunct program to the repealer section of the bill. So that statute will be repealed in the A4 amendment. Second, on page 7, line 23 of the unofficial engrossment, this is regarding dual training grants. If you see on lines 22 to 24 of page 7 of the unofficial engrossment, paragraph B, this paragraph was stricken in the as introduced version of the bill. In the A4 amendment, it reinstates that stricken language and clarifies that the requirements to apply for Pell and state grants are only applicable if the employee receiving training under the grant program is attending an institution that is actually eligible to receive state financial aid. Finally, the last substantive change made by the A4 amendment is on page 19 of the unofficial engrossments. At line 6, in the as introduced version, and this concerns when a student is withdrawing from a private career school and may or may not be eligible for a refund. Regarding how a student withdraws from the program, the as introduced version of the bill said that a student may notify a private career school by any means. The A4 amendment instead states that a student is simply not required to provide a written notice. Madam Chair, members, so that wraps up all of the substantive changes made by the A4 amendment. Everything else in the amendment is really just technical changes.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Is there any discussion to the A4 amendment? Hearing none, those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Madam Chair, really quick.
Well, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I had to like make my screen bigger. I was trying to follow along and I have just our computer, so it's a challenge. Okay. No, I just wanted to let my members know that those changes in the A4 were actually very good changes, and in particular, the section about the dual training and reinstating that someone actually does have to apply for Pell grants and state grants is actually really important. It was sort of fundamental and foundation, the foundation of doing this dual training program. So I appreciate that you reinstated that language. I'm not quite sure why it was deleted, but that was really critical. And I also appreciate, Chair Bernardi, that you heard my concerns about the income contingency loan section that had been kind of defunct since 1995, and the agency wanted to change it into something else. And I appreciate you just removing that, and we can have that more substantive conversation at another time. With that, I would encourage my members to support the A4.
Thank you, Representative. Any other members would like to speak to the amendment? Okay, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A4 motion prevails and the A4 amendment is adopted. Representative Bernardi's second author's amendment is labeled A3. I will move A3 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author wants. Does everyone have the amendment? I will once again ask Mr. Hopkins to give us an overview of the changes that the A3 amendment makes.
Madam Chair and members, so this concerns a change that the Office of Higher Education wanted to make to the data practices provisions in the statutes concerning the state's 529 college savings program. This changes that language somewhat regarding data sharing. It specifies that the kinds of data, account owner data, that the Office of Higher Education can share with the Department of Revenue are limited to the account owner's name and Social Security number. It also specifies that the Department of Revenue is only going to be compiling studies under Section 270B.04. This section allows the Department of Revenue to compile statistical studies that don't identify any individual taxpayer or contain any information that could potentially identify individual taxpayers. It's just high-level statistical studies. It also sort of tightens up the language and makes it clear that the purposes for data sharing authorized by this paragraph is purely for evaluative research and analysis to help the Office of Higher Education make more informed decisions regarding how it administers the state's 529.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Is there any discussion? Representative O'Neill, do you have something to say?
Just very quickly. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And to Chair Bernardi, thank you for fixing this section. It was something that came up in Judiciary, and I believe this was a compromise. And I do appreciate you hearing the concerns laid out in Judiciary. And I won't go into those because that's in their jurisdiction, but I do acknowledge that this is a good amendment, and I ask my members to support it. And with that, I would accept just a voice vote on this one as well.
Okay, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed? The motion prevails and the A3 amendment is adopted. We have before us House File 1181. Chair Bernardi, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today we have before the committee House File 1181. This is an Office of Higher Education agency bill. It contains various substantive and technical changes to higher education statutes regarding financial aid, scholarships, regulations of post-secondary institutions, and state college savings plans. I have the Office of Higher Education today to be able to walk through the provisions. But before I call on them, I'd like to point out a few policy highlights that are student-supported, centered within the bill. COVID-19 has disrupted higher education path for students. The bill helps ease the burden of the pandemic's impact by extending eligibility to the state grant or child care grant program if students were forced to take time away from school to care for a sick loved one or themselves. The bill breaks down barriers for students and graduates who need access to their transcript records. We know how important it is to have proof of post-secondary experience when someone is applying for a job or another training program. And although these are simple fixes, they are important and necessary, especially for our students' economic security. And lastly, I want to highlight what the provisions that help protect our students from from private institutions that abruptly close or are at risk of closing. We heard heartbreaking testimony together the last 2 years when Argosy students lost their credits, their financial security, and all of their hard work. And we want to be sure this never happens again in Minnesota. So, Madam Chair, I'd now like to call on the Office of Higher Education to walk through the provisions of the bill.
Ms. Nikki Oliver?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Manager of Grants and Government Relations for the Office of Higher Education. And thank you for allowing us to be able to walk through and explain our agency policy bill with you all today. I have several colleagues that will actually go through their specific sections of the bill because they are the content experts here with me, and I will pass it over to them as we get to their sections. So section one, and I believe we're following through the unofficial engrossment. Section one is related to transcript access and transcript holds because of student account debt. We know from a program we currently have in our agency, the Minnesota Reconnect program, and several other anecdotal instances that students have a barrier when it comes to small financial holds and accessing their transcripts. And so this language seeks to eliminate that barrier. And I will allow Meredith Fergus from our office to explain more what these specific provisions are doing.
Ms. Fergus, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I am the Director of Research for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. So this section of the bill actually came out of a lot of the work of Minnesota Reconnect, as well as meetings with other higher education systems across the nation, as we met to kind of determine the best practices for serving adult learners in Minnesota. So one thing we realized is that when a student incurs a debt to a college, and most of the time we're thinking of tuition, but it actually can include library fines, parking fees, bookstore charges, and other kind of bills that are owed to the institution, that our colleges have a variety of policies and practices for how they approach those repayments. For example, if a student has an unpaid balance from tuition, library fines, parking, the college may drop the student from currently enrolled classes, restrict use of college services, deny their residence dining hall privileges, prevent them from enrolling in future classes, not only at their institution, but if they're at a public institution within any institution in that system. They can also prevent the student from graduating, from obtaining their diploma. They can assess late fees either once or repeatedly. They can refer the balance to a collections agency or the Department of Revenue for recapture. The goal in this statute is to essentially put some boundaries on the policies for transcript access holds so that colleges do more proactive thinking in how this kind of tactic plays into student success. And so we've worked with our colleges to kind of come up with some options for them. Madam Chair and or Representative Bernardi and Nikki, did you want me to walk through each section?
Yes, please.
Certainly, Madam Chair. The first section is our definition section, and we came up with some common definitions related to debt, which is money owed the college, as well as school, which is the colleges that would be impacted, and then transcript. We're using a definition that includes both official transcripts as well as unofficial transcripts provided by a school. Subdivision 2 represents the prohibited practices. These are the things that we want colleges to think about should they be using transcript holds as a debt collection tactic. So we would like to prohibit the transcript holds or prohibit refusal of a transcript in the following circumstances. If the debt owed by a student is less than $500. If the student has entered into and is in compliance with a payment plan with the school, if the transcript request is made by an employer, and if the school has sent the debt for repayment either to the Department of Revenue or a collections agency. We would also like to prohibit colleges from charging additional fees or a higher fee for obtaining a transcript to students who owe a debt to the school and meet the circumstances above. In terms of institutional policy, we would like to see colleges who use transcript holds as a tool for debt collection to have a policy that is accessible to students and clearly outlines the practices by which they will hold or they will collect on debts owed the institutions. We would also like to see institutions using a transcript hold in the fewest number of cases possible. With that, Madam Chair, that is the section one.
Sorry, this is Nikki. Sorry, I don't know if you want me to just keep going or pause to let you like reintroduce me.
Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Oliver.
Thank you.
Continue, thank you.
So section two and section three are, as Representative Bernardi had mentioned, those expansions to financial aid for students who have a extended family member, either a child, a spouse, or a parent that they are in care of that have suffered an illness and they need to take care, a serious health condition. So it essentially reinstates any financial aid that they would have lost during that time. And then section four is our the student loan refinancing. So this is eliminating the caps for our student refinancing program. And I would like to pass it over to Marilyn Kozier. And I believe going forward, our staff will just high level each section and not go to talk about each specific change, but specifically just in general, what the changes are to the section for the sake of time. So Marilyn Kozier is the person I would like to pass to for section four.
Before we move on, Representative O'Neill, did you have a question?
Just a very quick one in the previous section, and then I do have an amendment for this particular section. But the previous section, I noticed that in the underlying bill, it was $1,000 debt, and now in Chair Bernardi's amendment, it went down to $500. And I was just curious as to what the change, I realize that's a big change, so I'm just wondering why the change.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Oliver can add, we've been in conversations with the colleges. Many of them had very low numbers, such as $25, $100. And while the office was proposing $1,000, we did come to consensus that we could meet in the middle with those institutions. And so that is where $500 came from.
And Madam Chair, sorry, if I can add, and the reason being that we didn't want to go to $25 or $50 is that we've seen an average, the average hold is about $750 for students. So $25 would be extremely low.
Representative O'Neill.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. That was all for that section.
Thank you. And proceed, Ms. Oliver.
Actually, I'm having Ms. Kozier talk through section four.
Thank you, Ms. Kozier. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm Marilyn Kozier, manager of the self and self-refi programs for the office. In 2014, the legislature authorized our office to offer loans to refinance student loan debt. We considered this a pilot program and established conservative limits of $70,000 for individual loans and a cap of $100 million for the overall program. With over 4 years of experience with the program, we believe we could better meet the needs of more Minnesota residents by having the authority to increase the loan limit. In looking at the limits of our peers and other state-based refinancing programs and other private lenders, our limits are much lower. Most state-based lenders that are similar to the self-refi have limits of $250,000 or more, with some states such as North Dakota and many private lenders not having a limit. We all have heard the stories of Minnesotans struggling with student loan debt. In fact, in previous committee hearing, we heard testimony for House File 1493, Student Borrowers Bill of Rights, from two Minnesotans who have approximately $145,000 and $183,000 of debt. Our limits of $70,000 could not even cover half of their debt if they were trying to refinance. We are requesting the flexibility to establish the limits since student loan debt loads continue to change over time, as do the needs of our Minnesota residents. In determining the annual limit, the statute directs the office to take into consideration funding capacity, delinquency and default loss management, levels of student debt, current financial market conditions, and other conditions to protect the financial stability of the program. Our initial conservative approach led us to establishing $100 million on the overall refi volume since we were uncertain about the demand and wanted to make sure we continued to have adequate funding for our in-school self program. We are now comfortable that we have adequate funding for both programs. We are not aware of any other state loan program that has program caps for individual loan programs. We believe the self-refi program is a good option for Minnesota residents to help them manage the student debt load that they have already taken on. The proposed changes allow the program to better meet the changing needs of Minnesota residents so they can benefit from our low interest rates. Our rates range from 2.5% to 5.3% compared to over 13% that residents have refinanced through our program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kozier. Representative O'Neill, did you have another question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an amendment to actually remove this section, but we can talk about that when we get to the amendment section. But I was just wondering what the default rate was currently and what the default rate would go to if you're refinancing loans as high as $300,000 or more. And why you didn't just ask us for a change in the cap number as opposed to just let you as the agency decide what the cap is going to be.
Ms. Kozier, proceed.
Madam Chair, the default rate so far has been relatively low, looking at under 1%. We would anticipate that there would be an increase if the loan limits were increased, and I couldn't project exactly what that rate would be. And again, that's something we would continue to monitor as we look at setting the limits.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we were just going to change the cap and let the legislature decide what that cap was going to be, what would be a cap amount that you would be comfortable with? Was it, say, $250,000 for a loan amount, $300,000? Is there a cap that you'd be comfortable with? Because I think it still needs to be legislative decision as opposed to the executive branch and the agency deciding how much you can refinance of a student's debt, especially if the default rate's going to go up.
Ms. Kozier.
I think Thomas Sanford, our Assistant Commissioner of Operations, I think wants to answer that question.
Okay, please proceed.
Hey, Madam Chair, this is Thomas Sanford, Assistant Commissioner for Operations. Thank you for the opportunity and Representative O'Neill just to kind of answer two of your questions. One, about the default rates. I think it's really important to note that these loans are likely to be pledged at some point into future bond transactions. Currently in those bond transactions is the incentive to make sure that our default rates stay low. The pricing increases substantially if rates start to increase. And so it's everybody's interest, and we are very cognizant. We have, I would argue, one of the lowest default rates of any state-based program in the nation. In fact, the averages that we've seen are well above 14% for most loan programs. So the fact that our in-school program is below 2% and our refi is under 1%, even though it's relatively new, is a good sign. Secondly, in terms of the cap, we can certainly work with you. We want to make sure we have enough flexibility to serve those borrowers. Because again, we're not expanding debt here. We're trying to help borrowers who already have existing debt refinance into lower rates. We are asking for the ability to set that with the office because we do monitor this very closely. It's similar with our current in-school program. We have the ability to set those limits for the in-school program currently. So we're trying to mirror that language. I will tell you that even in the in-school program, we've had that ability and we have some of the lowest caps of most in-school programs currently still with that authority. So we generally take a very conservative approach. We're typically very slow in moving and have every intention of putting borrowers in the best situations possible so that they're positioned to be successful both while they're in school and after they graduate.
Representative Bonilla.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I still think the legislature should be deciding what the student loan cap should be. Yes, we have an exploding issue with students taking out extraordinary debt, over 100,000, over 200,000, approaching 300,000. They have debt that's beyond anything. That's more than my house. That's more than double what I owe on my house. well, it's actually three times more than what I owe on my house. So I think the legislature needs to decide what the student cap should be. Right now it's at 70,000. And if you want to go to 200,000 or something like that, I would be open to that conversation. But I think, you know, this last year has shown us that the legislature should be involved and should have a say in what the administration does, and to just allow the agency to decide what they can do in this program. I'm not quite ready to go there just yet. So I would ask you to decide a number, whether it be 200,000. I mean, that's more than double 70,000. And let's reevaluate. You do come before the legislature every year, so it's not like this is once and done. We certainly can evaluate it again next year, but I would be more willing to just take the cap away on the 100 million, because I realize there's lots and lots of parameters there. But on the student loan amount, refi amount, I'd like to pick a number and put a number in. That's why I drafted the amendment to delete this entire change. Once again, I would like the legislature to make these decisions and not an agency. So that's my concern there. And if you want to pick 200,000, 250,000, we can have that conversation up from 70. But that's my concern. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Sanford.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. Certainly open to having those conversations. I just want to stress again, obviously, that and I know you understand this, but just in case it's not clear for others, that this is debt that borrowers already have. We're not expanding that access to debt. You know, they've already taken out these loans. And so, as Marilyn mentioned, we've had cases where borrowers have refinanced loans with interest rates as high as 13%. And so giving them that break of a 5% or below interest rate saves them significantly over the life of the loan. And so what we're really trying to do here is just expand access for more Minnesotans who are really struggling with those high debt loads and are struggling with those high payment amounts to try to make that more manageable for them. So happy to have those conversations, and refer to Marilyn and Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Sanford. Representative O'Neill. Okay. Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that my question was just answered. It is for debt that the students already have acquired. And I'm wondering, how does, when a student takes debt and sometimes the interest has been capitalized within that debt, does that also factor into the amounts that these students would have in their debt? If that makes sense, that may be a little confusing.
Mr. Sanford?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I'm going to defer to Marilyn Kozier. This is her kind of specialty, and she would be in a better position to answer that question.
Thank you.
Ms. Kozier.
Madam Chair, yes, if the interest has already been capitalized, it is included in the principal that they could refinance into this loan.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Cleaver.
Thank you. And could you just speak a little bit about what that is, capitalized interest, so that members of the public would understand what I'm talking about?
Ms. Kozier.
Madam Chair. So at certain points in time, lenders will capitalize interest. And what that means is you have ongoing interest that you don't pay interest on. Once it's added into that principal balance, so say you owed $10,000 and they capitalized $100, you would now pay interest on $10,100. So by capitalizing interest, you do end up paying more interest because it gets added to your principal balance of what you owe.
Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to make sure this is really clear. sometimes when students are studying and they're unable because they're continuing their studies, that interest continues to accrue while they're completing their studies. And then when it comes time, they've graduated and they're going to start paying their loans, the interest that has accrued during that period of time is added now as if it were money that they borrowed. And so in fact, they continue to pay interest on their interest. Is that correct?
Ms. Kocher.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct. You have stated that correctly. Once the interest is capitalized, they are now paying interest on that new amount, which is essentially just like they borrowed that amount originally.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Ms. Oliver.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to make sure we can get to the next several sections because this manager actually has to go at 4:30. And I know Representative O'Neill, as she mentioned, had an amendment specifically to the SELF. So I think we can, if possible, get to some of those additional questions regarding that actual program itself, if that's possible.
I believe I should go to Representative Danielson and see if he quickly has a question.
Thank you, Chair. Just a note that our caucus starts at 4:30, and that's been a tradition to have that stay at the same day, the same time. So I don't know if we can wrap this up by 4:30 or if we have to meet later, but that's the request by our caucus, is make sure we can do our caucus meeting at the regular time.
Thank you, Representative. And Ms. Oliver, please proceed.
Thank you. So the next several sections, I believe section 5 through 12, are regarding the dual training grants. And I will let Megan Fitzgibbon briefly explain what these changes are and just as a high level overview, as there are several sections here.
Okay, and I do ask that we try to move along quickly. And is it Ms. Kocher?
Fitzgibbon, Megan Fitzgibbon.
Megan, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yes, my name is Megan Fitzgibbon. I'm a state financial aid manager with the office. And sections 5 through 12 are amendments to the statute for the Minnesota dual training grant program. All of these amendments essentially establish in statute current practices for the grant, or they make the application process a little bit easier for the applicants. I'll just kind of briefly go over a few. We add in a definition section. So section 6 establishes a definition subdivision. And then a majority of the other amendments in these sections basically just conform to that definitions subdivision, so that the rest of the statute is pointing to the correct, you're using the right term that's in definitions. The only other thing that is not necessarily related to the training or is in section 10, where we amend the meaning of large employer, and a large employer in this program is required to provide a match. And in this case, we're just following kind of guidance from the Attorney General to ensure that we are using the right definition for a large employer, and what we're already doing in practice, and in referring to a business with more than $25 million in gross revenue. Previously, it was just revenue, and we had to get clarification from all the stakeholders to try to clarify, you know, what the word, you know, which revenue we're talking about, and we've been using gross revenue for the last several years. Other than that, I can stand if there's questions for this as well.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since I was the author of this way back in 2015, I think it was, I just have a quick question. Line 6.1 through 6.4, you're deleting language that allows an employee who only needs a partial kind of completion in order to get their degree or certification. So if they don't need to actually relearn what they already know, basically you're taking that part out. And can you explain why you're doing that? Is that moving to another section? I couldn't really track where it went unless you're just getting rid of it altogether.
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Madam Chair, Representative Neal, yes. What we've actually done in this amendment is we have moved, we haven't really removed that, but what we've said is that the required training or what's eligible training must be include training to meet one or more identified competency standard. So instead, we're kind of doing the opposite. So we're not saying it has to be all of the identified competency standards in a particular occupation. We're just saying it has to be towards one or more. You know, we're just, like I said, we're just kind of doing the opposite so that it's clear that it has to have at least one or more of those identified competencies, but there's no requirement that it has to be towards all of the competencies that might be identified in a given occupation.
Representative O'Neill.
Yep, that's it. Thank you. Just want to make sure what exactly they were changing there. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Oliver.
Thank you. So section 13 through I believe 21 are related to changes within our degree and non-degree guaranteeing statutes. And I will let Betsy Talbot talk high level and very fast about these. I think the things that I think are most important to highlight here are the risk analysis and I believe the records piece. So I will allow Betsy Talbot, who is the manager over our licensing and registration, to talk high level about what's happening here. And I believe Representative Bernardi touched on why a lot of this is happening, especially the risk analysis is carryover from that school closure bill that that you all passed last year and the year before to mitigate risk for students attending private institutions, especially if they're closing. Betsy Talbot could talk more about the work we've done with the institutions on this risk analysis language to be more collaborative in that process. So if you don't mind, Madam Chair, I'd like to pass it over to Betsy Talbot.
Ms. Talbot.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. I'm Betsy Talbot. I'm the manager of institutional registration and licensing. I'm responsible for the oversight of the private institutions in our state. So the first couple sections, section 13 and section 14, they're actually kind of related to the Argosy closure and making sure we have kind of the correct type of provisions in law that has the right triggers and puts schools on the right type of notice. One is that change of ownership if they enter into receivership, which is kind of a bankruptcy light type of legal status. And then also for school closure, previously, when we talked about student records, we think transcripts, but the Argosy closure opened up to us that we also have to think about those types of clinical training records that are necessary for licensure for these students, including those that have already graduated. So we want to make sure that schools are on notice that those are also really important records for employment purposes, and that we want to make sure that those are maintained in the event of a closure. Section 15 is just a technical change because the U.S. Department of Education eliminated the regional accreditor concept. And so we're just naming the regional accreditor for our state instead. And then most importantly, Section 16. This is the area where we really needed to beef up and be more collaborative with our institutions about communicating risk of a closure or other problems with an institution and how we deal with that risk and kind of make sure that we are covering what's needed for students. So we started working with our institutions for over a year. We invited all the institutions to come and collaborate and help write this language with us to kind of identify a process of how we would work with them collaboratively to discuss risk factors and how to address those risk factors. We do know that there are going to be financial and non-financial indicators. So things are pretty obvious for financial, like do you have cash on hand? And some non-financial indicators could be issues with accreditation, issues with enrollment, maybe all the faculty from a department suddenly leave. And we just want to touch bases with our institutions to kind of discuss what's going on, how they're going to mitigate that harm to students, and then kind of come up with a game plan, essentially, and if need be, put certain restrictions in place on that institution to help safeguard those students. So it kind of goes over different triggers, and again, that determination process and how we would communicate with the institution and give them that communication process back to us so that we can understand the risk from their perspective. Scrolling down, section 17 is that section about records that we discussed, again, making sure that we have those clinical training records. We want to make sure that our students who graduate from a school that ends up closing 10 years down the road still can receive licensure in that field. And section 18 is just duplicative. So we have two statutes that we administer. One is for degree granting institutions and the other statute or act is for the non-degree granting. So section 18 is going to be basically the same language, but for those licensed schools, you know, everything from horseshoeing to some of the cosmetology schools that we also regulate. Same with section 19 is going to be duplicative language that we had discussed previously because it also applies. We want consistency with between the two types of schools, those degree granting and their non-degree granting institutions. And then section 20 is we are actually aligning the renewal kind of trigger process for those small license schools. They don't have a change of ownership trigger for a renewal license. And then previously their renewal licenses were kind of based on some federal provisions that just don't really apply to those institutions anymore. So we're repealing the old language and then adding in a change of ownership, new application material, which is important to like update bonds, the names of institutions, et cetera, when a change of ownership occurs. Section 21 is a refund policy that only applies to non-degree granting institutions, again, like horseshoeing and cosmetology programs, massage programs, where we really need to give better guidance and notice to schools about how to make a refund in the event a student withdraws or fails to show up. This is really clock hour programs. So these are programs where they're measured by the hour, not by term or semester. And it gets really confusing for schools on how to process these refunds because some schools only meet once a month or some schools meet every day, Monday through Friday. And anything in between there gets really hard for schools to help explain to them how they should make refunds to students. So the goal here is again, to make the refund process simpler to them, more instructive for them, because we frequently find it among audits and we want to eliminate that issue for institutions and for the student.
Thank you, Betsy.
Thank you, Ms. Talbot. Ms. Oliver, do you have more to say?
So just briefly there, we already talked about section 23, which is that data sharing between the Department of Revenue when Nathan talked about the amendment and the purpose there. And then the repealers are obsolete rules. And Betsy already referred to this language as being stricken because it's being reinstated elsewhere in the bill. So that's all for our bill. And I know there's a few amendments and you need time for questions, but thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. Representative Sandell, real quick. I believe you're muted, Representative.
Sorry, Representative Christensen, Madam Chair. Ms. Talbot, when you talk about private and out-of-state public institutions, how many are you talking about and how many Minnesota students are enrolled in those organizations?
Are you talking about, sorry, Madam Chair, Representative, are you talking about like our private degree granting?
Well, Section 17 and several of the following, it refers to private and out-of-state public institutions. And I just wondered how many of those there are and how many of our students maybe might be enrolled in them.
So there's approximately 34 in-state institutions, and then we have about 100 out-of-state institutions who are not eligible for a reciprocity agreement. So think some national-based institutions in California, who this provision would apply to if they're enrolling Minnesota residents. And the numbers, I might call on Meredith for the guess because she's better at the enrollment numbers than I am as the head of our research department.
We can also follow up with you, Representative, on those numbers, actually, because I know you guys are cutting close to time.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if I missed something, but how did the amendment change the 529 plan data?
Ms. Talbot?
I think that's a question for me. Sorry, Madam Chair.
Okay, Ms. Oliver.
Yeah, the amendment specified what information would be shared with the Department of Revenue and what information we would actually get back from the Department of Revenue. So it was more specific, so it's not broad, and also specified how we would use that summary level information we get from the Department of Revenue. And it was incorporating feedback we got from Judiciary.
So, Madam Chair.
Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative
Ms. Oliver, did you check with those who hold 529 plans to find out if they want their, if they want a research and analysis done of what they're doing with the 529?
Ms. Oliver?
Madam Chair, so Representative Erickson, we have to notify them of this new, like, that we will be sharing with the what we will be doing, and they get the option to opt out of whether or not they want their information shared. It's actually for the purpose of our agency, so we can do better outreach, so we can identify, like, if we don't see a certain, like, maybe income threshold utilizing the 529 plan, because we just know that there's benefit in any sort of savings for college. So we can do better outreach. That's the primary purpose of this. So we can do better targeted outreach, and they will have the option to opt out of this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Oliver, thank you for clarifying that there can be an opt out. I think that's important. Thank you.
Okay, so now it's time to hear Representative O'Neill's amendment. Members, there is an amendment labeled A1. Who is offering the amendment?
Representative O'Neill is offering the O'Neill amendment.
Okay. Representative O'Neill, would you like to move your amendment?
Actually, Madam Chair, I would consider not offering this in lieu of doing a small oral amendment in that section after the conversation, both before the committee hearing and during the committee hearing with OHE. And I'll suggest my amendment and then see, because if we can adopt this small oral amendment, I could offer my support to this bill and encourage my members to vote for the bill. If we don't do that, I probably would not be supportive of this bill this time. We'll see what it does later, but I'll tell you what the oral amendment, what I suggest would be. So specifically on line 4.42 of the unofficial engrossment, changing 70,000, which is stricken right now, to 250,000, which would allow up to $250,000 of debt to be refinanced, for the student debt to be refinanced under this program. I would leave the remainder of the language intact, but that would be my small oral amendment suggestion to gain my support for the bill. So again, changing 70,000 to 250,000, and that is in the middle of line 4.24.
And should Mr. Sanford respond to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill. The office is in support of that amendment, so thank you for offering it.
Thank you. Thank you, Deb.
Thank you, Mr. Sanford. Representative Bernardi. You're muted, Chair.
If you can go to Mr. Hopkins first and then call on me then.
Okay, Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, I just want to clarify the oral amendment for the committee and for the committee legislative assistant for purposes of the minutes. So this would be page 5, line 3 of the bill, because you have to amend the bill. We wouldn't amend the unofficial engrossment, so we're amending the bill itself. Page 5, line 3, the amendment is reinstate. Gosh, sorry. This is more complicated than it seems like it should be. But the amendment would be page 5, line 3, delete the new language, reinstate may not exceed. May not exceed 70,000. So the amendment would be page 5, line 3, delete the new language, reinstate the stricken language, and delete 70,000. Insert 250,000. So, Madam Chair and members, that would be the amendment. Page 5, line 3, delete the new language, reinstate the stricken language, and delete 70,000 and insert $250,000.
And Chair Bernardi.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Hopkins, real quick. Would it be easier just to make a verbal amendment and change the 70,000 to 250,000 and withdraw the amendment if Representative O'Neill was okay with that? I just wanted to throw that idea out.
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi. So Representative O'Neill has made an oral amendment.
Okay.
So this would be the oral amendment that would have to be made.
Yes, Madam Chair, I did withdraw, or actually I didn't even present, to be honest with you, the A1. In lieu of presenting the A1 as a motion, I instead offered the oral amendment exactly as Mr. Hopkins stated. That is exactly it.
Okay, can you, Madam Chair?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Can you just restate it again? Because I'm understanding that it changes 70,000 to 250,000, and that's what the essence of it is. I just want to verify that.
Okay, so as I understand it, on page 5, line 3, we're going to be changing $70,000 to $250,000. Is that correct? Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. And then, Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just want to, Representative O'Neill and I talked about this earlier, and I'm okay with this amendment. This is something that we can continue to work on and monitor to make sure that it is the correct amount. And so I would accept that, I would support that amendment of this bill.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. With that, you'll have my support and my members.
Thank you, Chair. And Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, I just wanted to point out one other thing that might need to be added into this oral amendment in order to make it all make sense. At page 5, line 4, it's this new language that's in the amendment deals with determining the annual limit. The office under the oral amendment is no longer going to be determining an annual limit for the maximum loans that can be refinanced under this section. So I would add to the oral amendment, page 5, line 4, delete annual limit and insert maximum amount of outstanding loans refinanced. Because the office is still, with the oral amendment, going to be determining a maximum amount of outstanding loans refinanced, but they are no longer going to be determining the maximum loan that can be refinanced under the program. So just to clarify here, the oral amendment would be page 5, line 3, delete the new language, reinstate the stricken language, and delete 70,000 and insert 250,000. Page 5, line 4, delete the annual limit and insert the maximum amount of outstanding loans refinanced.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hopkins. You're challenging my new chair skills here. So now can we have a voice vote on this amendment? Has it been clarified enough that we can take a voice vote? I'm asking Chair Bernardi.
Madam Chair, yes, and yes, I am supportive of this amendment and appreciate continuing to monitor this with Representative O'Neill and work together to make sure this is the proper amount. Thank you.
Okay, and Mr. Hopkins.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I just forgot to lower my
hand. Okay. So all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 And those opposed? So the amendment is adopted. So, Chair Bernardi, do you have any closing comments about your bill?
Yes, I would like to thank the testifiers today and for our members for working on this bill to create it to be a very good bill to keep our students centered and in our bill and to help them become successful and to address a number of issues that we've identified in here with student loans, addressing COVID and taking care of families and making sure that they get their transcripts. There's a lot of important work that's gone into this bill from the agency and all of our members, and I appreciate us working together and ask for your vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Chair Bernardi will renew her motion that House File 1181 be amended and referred to the Committee on Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs. The clerk will take the roll.
Vice Chair Christensen.
Aye.
Christensen, aye. Chair Bernardi.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, aye.
O'Neill, aye. Representative Albright.
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Daniels.
Aye.
Daniels, aye. Representative Erickson.
Aye.
Erickson, aye. Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen. Representative Heintzman. Representative Heintzman. Representative Howard. Representative Howard. Representative Keeler.
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne, aye.
Cleburne, aye. Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Kosnick, aye. Representative Kreshaw. Representative Mason.
Aye.
Mason, aye. Representative Meckland. Representative Meckland. Representative Knorr.
Knorr, aye.
Knorr, aye. Representative Sandell.
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Sandsted.
Sandsted, aye.
Sandsted, aye. Representative Thompson.
Thompson, aye.
Thompson, aye. There are 14 ayes, 0 nays, and 5 absent.
Okay, thank you, members. And with that, the bill will be moved to the Committee of Labor, and I believe we can now adjourn the meeting.